And out of the sun's gates come little girls in dresses of fire, wearing pigtails of braided smoke, which stem from their moon-painted scalps.
Hey, what's up, everybody? Welcome to The Checkout. Also, a podcast. You know that. You can get it on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, wherever you get your podcasts. Our show is always produced on our homepage. You can find it, checkoutjazz.org. Produced at WBGO 88.3 FM in Newark. I'm Simon Rentner. We have an incredible show today for you, actually, because we're going to be heading to Antwerp, Belgium, where I gave a talk last summer about black music. And we have an incredible panel of thinkers, artists, musicians, creatives in general that all have unique black experiences and can share their thoughts on the subject, including Saul Williams, David Murray, Rashawn Carter, and the rapper Kokai. But before we get to that portion of the program, we are fundraising here at this historic jazz public radio station. One of our gift packages we are offering in celebration of WBGO and The Checkout, a new album entitled New Masters, some of the baddest, youngest jazz cats interpreting music in our current popular sphere. We have Sullivan Fortner, the brilliant pianist, interpreting Drake. We have the Israeli guitarist Gilad Hexelman breaking down Juice WRLD, rest in peace. The brilliant drummer Eric Harlan interpreting, I can't even believe it myself, Cardi B. And for an $88 contribution in support of The Checkout, this recording can be yours. New Masters, Reworks, Volume 1. We are waiting for your contribution for $88 in support of WBGO. 1-800-499-9246, or go online to WBGO.org in support of WBGO, in support of The Checkout, and most importantly, in support of the music. And thank you. So here we go. We're on our way back to Belgium, to Antwerp, at the 50th Jazz Middelijm Festival, where I hosted a panel entitled Black Music. Yes, me, the white guy. And as you'll hear, it's an incredible open conversation talking about the black experience today, especially when it comes to creation. The rapper and poet Saul Williams collaborates with David Murray on the saxophonist's latest recording, Blues for Memo, and some of those lyrics from that album can also be heard on Saul Williams' new recording called Encrypted and Vulnerable.
From the sky.
That music will also then be provided for Saul Williams' upcoming musical and film entitled Neptune Frost, where it follows the story of African hackers living in a village made of upcycled computer parts. And if you haven't seen the trailer for that film yet, just go and do it right now. What is there to say about David Murray? I mean, he's just one of the greatest saxophonists of his generation, and you can dig into our archives and listen to our previous conversation together, illustrating his illustrious career. And then we have David Murray's bassist, Rashawn Carter. And lastly, and certainly not least, a rapper, a singer, a poet by the name of Kokai, and he has a brand new recording coming out this Monday, December 16th on Bandcamp called Hubris. What you're listening to right now is from that new recording called Mermaid.
She said it's cold down here in the shallow. I keep a hound there by the reef. We keep them sharks at bay now with these games. So baby, make sure you don't bleed. Whoa.
Those are our panelists, so now let's take you on stage in front of our live audience in the middle of the beautiful Van Brunt Park in Antwerp, Belgium, in a conversation about black music, black cinema, and how black art is too often defined by the white establishment, from jazz to hip-hop. And a quick note, there's a lot of adult content in this podcast and swear words, so if you're listening with any kids, please be mindful of that. Thanks for checking in.
Give it up for Jazz Middelijm celebrating 50 years of presenting jazz in Belgium. How many jazz festivals are 50 years old, period? Just kudos to you for embracing the music, bringing it into your hearts, and celebrating some of these phenomenal musicians that we have on stage today. The name of this panel is Black Music, Activism, and the Role of the Modern Musician. And maybe we can begin with Saul and his words, because I've had a chance to speak with him over the years, and just enter the discussion with Saul, and maybe we'll end with Saul. So we'll go from there. I asked him, why is it that the African-American diaspora in general, worldwide, is appropriated at the level that it is, you know, by everybody? Why does it speak to the hearts, and why does it communicate so directly around the world with every culture?
In order to go into space, for example, you know, an astronaut, and they're going to start commercial travel soon, right? So there's months of preparation that's needed to know what it's like to exist in 0.60 gravity and all this stuff, right? So you have to do training in order to go into space. The training and the thing that distinguishes the African-American experience pretty much starts with the Middle Passage. You think of months in the hull of a ship, right? Where, you know, like, to imagine hell is privilege. If you're living hell, what do you imagine? And it's not a hell where it stops. It's like you keep breathing. You make the journey. You can't move. You know, you're stuck there. It's beyond worry. It's the worst thing that's ever happened. You may not speak the language of the people next to you or what have you, right? And it's going on for over a month. And it's dark. You're in the hull of a ship. You're not, like, sailing, you know? The argument has been made that it's in those holes of the ship that, you know, it's like a sweat lodge ceremony, you know? But in a spaceship, it's the idea of ritualistic transformation, where if you're in that position, what do you dream? What do you think? What do you say? How do you moan? Do you cry? Do you sing? Where does your mind travel? It's been argued that every art form that's come out of the African-American experience was born there. Because if we talk about the diaspora, and what is it that distinguishes, you know, all these people of the diaspora in Brazil and Cuba and Guyana and Jamaica and Haiti and America? It's that. Even, you know, generations after that experience has been had, because it's something, as opposed to a genocide, it's something that was lived through. A hell that was lived through. You know, the purpose of the Holocaust was to kill and murder the Jews. The purpose of this Holocaust was not to kill, it was to enslave. So they wanted to keep these cats alive, but they lived through, before they even got initiated or branded into slavery, that. And I think that that's the thing that births the cadence and births all of these unique things that are then held on generation after generation in some sort of transformative way, because hardly any of us could ever imagine what it's like. But, you know, then it's like what George Clinton says, the funk is its own reward.
How much do you all think about these things when you're creating your own music?
Well, those things are actually things that I try not to think about. I mean, because it's so disgusting. I'm doing a project right now. Well, when I started, Toni Morrison was alive, but she passed away, and I was supposed to write a suite for her, and I'm reviewing a lot of her texts. And she has some passages in her book about Middle Passage, and she speaks, well, you know, a lot of people survived, but there were a lot of people who died. The gentleman I worked with before I worked with Saul, Mary Baraka, he talks about, she got a poem, there's a railroad in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, Black Ivory, you know, he talks about the railroad created for the sharks that swim, and they're still swimming that path because of slave ships. Ishmael Reed, the writer that wrote Mumbo Jumbo, he talks about the exponent, that's the X factor of jazz, of what it came from. Parts of jazz started in Africa, not just in Middle Passage and not just in the Americas. Complex rhythm aspect of jazz is already in the people. And you get the slaves to the United States. The one thing that united them was perhaps also gospel music, hymns that they didn't understand, trying to relate to some kind of a gospel music. They have a slave owner, and the foreman of the slave men probably spoke very bad English, and they had a whip. And you have to learn English from a very bad-speaking English person. And all these languages coming together at the same time. You think about the first African-American poets, they're speaking very bad English. It's like country English, because they had bad teachers. But Saul was right in many aspects, but I don't like to dwell on that aspect because plenty of things happened in America after Middle Passage. But Middle Passage was something to suffer through. Most of the people didn't make it. Most of them didn't make it. If you look at this awful movie, Amistad, that came out some years ago, that actually is just an account of Herman Melville's Benito Cereno. So, you know, it's been documented.
What in that film, Amistad, particularly bothered you when you watched it? Were there any scenes that really pissed you off?
It was just so commercialized. The slaves themselves didn't get as much credit as they probably would do in their bravery in trying to rebel and do an uprising. It was maybe understated, I thought. A lot of Uncle Tom and all that kind of stuff, you know. I think there were a lot of very proud people there that probably perished because of the proudness.
America is a very ugly place. It can be beautiful, too. New York City is a beautiful place where a lot of great things happen. Mm-hmm. But America has an ugly side that we still can't reconcile with. So I'm curious, among younger generations like you guys, can you guys navigate these ideas? Has it changed since David Murray's generation?
I was thinking about, you know, we were listening to Saul and your question about, you know, how does this work into our creation? And we carry it with us, right? So we're finally talking about this idea of like genetic memory, and that so, you know, within my genes, within my bones, within my blood and skin and all of this, I'm carrying around the Middle Passage and Reconstruction and Civil War and I mean, so much that, you know, I'm trying to deal with that. It's James Baldwin says to be black in America with any kind of consciousness is to be in a rage all the time, you know? And so, you know, we deal with, so there's a lot to deal with, I think, especially as I was born in 1986, I'm 33. I missed a lot of history in terms of like standing and being there, but my bones carry this history. So in some ways it's there even without thinking about it. Also the things that we created ended up being our sort of meditation, our healing. For this sort of process. You know, for someone like myself, I'm dealing with finding ways to heal genes that I'm maybe not even aware of, to heal those things, you know, honoring ancestors, spending time with elders. I first saw David when I was like, I think I might have been 11 or 12 or something like that. I remember we were talking about this last night. I saw him play with strings, and I was really into Bird with Strings at the time. My mother took me to the concert, and I was like, this is the most incredible thing I've seen. I was like, this is what I want to do. I want to be around for this. So that spoke to me, that sense of healing. That's like coming to terms with all of this that we're talking about. That was a means of healing. And to share a stage with him, it's a means to sort of like find some healing for our ancestors, create narratives for our future as well. There's a lot there. And sometimes it's maybe not easily quantifiable. You know, it's like we talk about spirit. That's an important conversation because sometimes when, you know, there's this idea like leave it to the spirit. Anything we maybe don't want to deal with or don't want to necessarily quantify into like a sort of scientific Western kind of thing is like, man, leave that to the spirit. So there's all these spaces moving around in our creation and you know, sort of the ways that we work.
You have anything to add?
We're kind of still dealing with Middle Passage thinking today from others, right? They still want to subjugate us. They still want to kill us and take these black bodies as threats,
right?
Just upon viewing us. Right, so to deal with the Middle Passage, even what Dave was saying, I can't watch, you know, we've been watching slave narratives since movies been being made, right? Mm-hmm. Where one person is never the victor, one person is, you know, always kowtowing or bowing their head, and maybe with Django, you got a little bit of revenge or whatever, but there's if America was truly honest about how slavery happened, they would never be able to show that movie. it would never be a movie. Right. They can never show it. It'll get an X rating, you know, not just because of rape and murder. You know, it'd be violence. It'd be everything. You know, so you can't even take the black experience and actually put it into a movie without fixing it, you know, so that it could be palatable. Because if people are actually faced with the horror of themselves, they really wouldn't go to that movie. That'd be the worst selling movie of all time.
Yeah. David Murray has been putting on shows for decades. He wasn't a founder, but he was a main component of the jazz loft scene taking place in New York City, where all kinds of concerts were just being put up in the Village, in random loft spaces, mostly homes. Basically, out of self-determination, needed a way to survive and succeed and express themselves. And so I'm going to play a clip of David Murray talking about who would show up at some of these loft parties.
I am the poet's musician. Now, I used to give parties at my loft. In one corner, I had Stanley Crouch. In the other corner, I had Amiri Baraka. In the other corner, I had Albert Murray. In the other corner, I had Ted Jones. And in the other corner, I had James Baldwin. You can't let these guys talk to each other in the party. F*** up your party. But some of these poet guys, they're just so angry at each other. Writers hate each other. They hate each other with a passion. You can't get these guys close to each other.
That sounds like a phenomenal party that I want to be at.
Well, I had five corners, see.
That's what I mean.
And I forgot a few people. I forgot Quincy Troop. Forgot a lot of other poets.
He was the one that wanted to party.
Yeah, well, you know, he went on to write the Miles Davis book, you know.
Yeah, let's just state the elephant in the room. I'm a white guy, you know, German ancestry. Here, I'm a white critic. And Murray Baraka wrote a lot about white critics in Black Music, one of the most important books that I've ever read in my lifetime. And if you haven't read it yet, I highly recommend. Oh, he goes by the name Leroy Jones at that time. But what's interesting to me about that quote, as I think about it, though, because within the white critical establishment, there's a lot of agreement going on and consensus. And you don't have this friction and disagreement that you speak of. It seems like a completely alternate universe from what I witness. So I want to ask you, David Murray, please unpack that for us.
Well, you know, actually, in the white writers community, there is a lot of friction. They can't stand each other either. And I've been around them as well. But, you know, when James Baldwin came onto the scene, you know, you have to, it's almost like you have to kill your father in order to stand on that box and talk, you know. When Stanley came to New York, his first guy he picked to fight with was Amiri Baraka. Ishmael Reed told me that Stanley was going for the championship, and I didn't understand what he was talking about, but now I do. But, you know, see, what happens is that white people that are in power in the publishing industry, they may not be white, or they could be Indian, or like Sonny Mehta, who's from Scribner. You know, these people, for some reason, when it comes to Negroes, African Americans, or colored, whatever you call them back in history, these guys are older. You could call them worse names than that. But now, I guess we're supposed to call ourselves African American, which is fine with me. With Negroes, it's fine. When you whatever, but you know, they pick one. It's like when we talk about jazz. If we go back to jazz, I mean, they had to pick Wynton Marsalis. They couldn't pick me. Because I'd have been a bad pick. It's like he was saying about history, you know. I would have told him to kiss my ass. Wynton don't tell people to kiss their ass, you know.
Do you have a good relationship with Wynton Marsalis?
Now I do. Now that he's grown up and stops talking. He came to get me, you know. I mean, when I first met him and his brother, they went down to New Orleans. They were kids at a high school. We did a workshop there to Kid Jordan brought us with the World Saxophone Quartet. And I seen these bright eyes, and you know, next thing I know, he's coming for me in New York. I said, okay, that's okay.
But, you know, we've grown through that. We've fought through that. You know, Stanley Crouch suicides and went with Winton. And you were talking about writers specifically. I'm going to address that question. Writers have to take each other's heads off because black history hasn't been completely written because it's been written by certain kinds of scholars that have been over-influenced by the certain kind of establishment. But people who actually know are just beginning to write their history. That's why Toni Morrison is so prolific, because there are characters in her books where there are no white people at all. And the white people are not used to reading books that aren't about them, especially when it comes to history. So you hit on that a little bit. But that's important. America has to be, yeah, there's a lot of people in America. That's why the voter bloc has to change. And it's changing now because America is becoming more black. It's becoming more colored. It's becoming browner as we speak. And then women are getting the consciousness that they may not have to vote along with their partners, their husbands. White supremacy is being challenged. And in the writer industry, that's also a fact. So when you have to pick one, I've used Wynton Marcellus as an example because that's in jazz. But in the writing community, they always want to have one spokesman at a time that's black. And that doesn't quite speak for all of the African Americans that exist out here. I mean, I know a lot of writers, and they don't all think the same. And we can't just follow one. I mean, okay, James Baldwin is popular now because he's dead, and because he had a movie come out, you know. But I don't have to sit and listen to Spike Lee as if he's some kind of political figure, which he's not. I mean, I like his directing.
Really, you don't think Spike Lee is a political figure?
No, I wouldn't follow him. Have you seen his movies?
Well, Do the Right Thing. Yeah, that movie changed my life.
Well, the good for you.
You got a point. I mean, within the society itself, especially when you deal with America, I'm not talking about the rest of the world, but when you deal with America, there's only room for one, and that's because they want to keep us portraying this monolith. Right, black people are not a monolith. Every black person is very different from the next black person. But if too many voices speak at the same time, then you might figure out that maybe people have opinions.
I mean, am I supposed to take this Black Klansman serious? I thought that was a comedy.
Yeah,
it was bullshit.
I wasn't a fan of that movie.
It was
bullshit
because it was really COINTELPRO.
Well, I mean, what I'm saying, right. if that's the representation of a whole colored people in African Americans, Negroes in America. If that's all we got, man, we don't have much. So I can't accept that. I need somebody else to follow. Well, you know, Obama was a good example. I could follow him, you know. I could follow Cory Booker. I could follow Mary's son, Ross Baraka. I mean,
there's
people I can follow, you know. I know there's parts of Reverend Sharpton that I could follow. There's parts of him that I can't. He's a friend, but we disagree on certain points. And wise people, they disagree. So why do we have to agree? Mm-hmm. Why do black people have to agree that there's one leader among us? Because there's never been. Even when Martin Luther King was around, he was not the only one. So people have to understand that we have varied stories, and we have different philosophies, and we don't have to agree.
It's important to not agree. I would advocate that we should be fighting to disagree more often so that we can come to a level playing field, which is maybe something that's becoming a little bit more difficult in this sort of overly political correct arena that we are navigating in now. I don't know. I ask you. In this new age, you don't think so?
It's not overly politically correct at this moment. They're actually working to reverse correctness, to just be politically assholes, like as much as you possibly can.
Yeah.
There's no, I remember growing up, you know, when you watch the news, there were people you could trust. So it was like Dan Rather or Morley Safer or, you know, Ann Curry or certain people like that. It was just one head, and they spoke about the news. They didn't interject their opinions, right? And now what we have are pundits. That's what we have. We don't have reporters. We don't have journalists. We have pundits. And people just want to spout their view just so they can get the ratings, and that's cool. But to tell the truth, to actually report the news, doesn't exist.
Like, for instance, if a journalist comes to you and they say their opinion, don't you agree? I say, hell no, I don't agree. No, why should I agree? Just because you said it? No. I'm tired, frankly tired, of somebody else deciding for me who I should listen to.
That leads me to, you brought up Wynton Marsalis, so let's go there. Who is, I would argue, shaped the cultural debate and defined what jazz is for maybe a generation, a decade or two. I don't know. What
possibly, maybe. So my generation, I'm seeing, now we're at a point where we're seeing like the, you know, the folks who we're seeing the results of jazz education, right? So when I was growing up playing jazz, I didn't play in a high school jazz band or anything like that. I was coming to see David play. I was, you know, my mother was doing a radio show. I was on her lap, you know, when she was doing the show. I was going to parties with my parents where, like, Carter Jefferson and folks like that were playing, you know, going to see Joe Henderson and stuff like that. So that's how I learned jazz, like within a black arts community.
Historically,
folks did.
Yeah.
This ain't how it goes now, right? Yeah. I go around the world, you know, teaching and talking to folks about jazz, and jazz education is a very different thing, and it rarely looks at that kind of experience. And a big part of what created what jazz education is today is Wynton Marsalis and jazz at Lincoln Center, whether he realized it or not. It did create this sort of like singular idea in terms of what a jazz musician is. Like, I remember being in middle school, and we had a substitute in the class, and so we have to watch a jazz video. They pull out the big laser disc, and it was Wynton Marsalis. They didn't show us Coltrane. They didn't show us Miles Davis. They showed us Wynton Marsalis. So for an entire, you know, for an entire generation of folks, at, you know, who grew up in the 80s and after, that's jazz. And there's not really a talk. You know, when you move the music out of communities, you lose this sort of diasporic culture that's been around forever, where you deal with an elder and you learn the music from an elder, you know. And so once you move it outside of the community, you know, there's a beautiful book with a bunch of black heavy brothers and sisters talking about Coltrane and Coltrane's connection to the black community. And one of the things they talk about is in black communities, you have to be invited to receive information. So elders have to deem you that you're someone who's worthy of carrying this information on. Mm-hmm. You know, once you get rid of that, then you change the way that folks are learning it and all this sort of stuff. And I'll say it doesn't have to happen in a black community, but it comes from a black community and it comes from that sort of way of that sort of process. So it can be done anywhere, but you got to deal with it that way. But yeah, it changed. And so then you start to see a sort of a singular kind of way of thinking about music. Then you start to see the aesthetic change. So a lot of times I'm feeling like I'm sometimes the dude on the outside because I grew up with jazz in a different way. When you're in a university, when you're in a high school jazz band and that sort of stuff, you're listening a certain way. You're listening to certain kinds of folks. I wasn't listening to that. You know, my folks were pretty radical, so we were listening to a lot of radical music. So my ears are radical, and I'm having a hard time dealing with folks on the inside and that sort of thing. So, but Wynton Marsalis, it ties into exactly what we're talking about, that you can't just have one singular, this idea of like the black everyman. It's a drag, and it's a drag for us when we have to deal with it, because when you're in a community, you see that there's so many ways of being black. As soon as you start to move further and further away from the community, you're not seeing it as this, you know, very, you know, distinct and vibrant thing with all these things going on. But it's like, okay, well, that's what it is, and let's pick one and let's deal with it. That's safe for us to deal with. You know?
It's also the historical removal of the historical process. It's an erasure of the process.
Right.
The griot was the person that held the stories.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
you know, in African culture, and the griot will pass down the stories to the next person. We still hold on to call and response. We still hold on to tales being told from our parents to grandparents to the parents to us to our children. Like, this is how we pass this information down. You pass down recipes the same way. You pass down practices the same way. Like, you know, this is what you do when you go outside, and this is how you navigate. You know, my dad's from Bed-Stuy, New York. You know, he told me all about the history of growing up in New York. My grandmother told him. You know, he told me. I tell my kids, like, this is what you do. You pass it down. You know, when you take it out of the historical process, especially if you're talking about jazz music, which was begat from this sort of process, right? The idea of taking something out of nothing, using instruments that were discarded by the wealthy, right, and making your own thing with the syncopated rhythms, the things that we came up with and initiated as a culture, as a people, at the onset, and then pass that information down. Those who couldn't read learn different ways. Those who could read would teach others to read. Like, these are things that happen. And when you remove the historical process out of something and then say, this is jazz. Well, according to whom? According to who? This definition was written by someone who is trying to place it in a Western context that has nothing to do with people. And it's one idea. It's one person's idea of how it's supposed to be, as opposed to a group of people that have decided this is how it is, or even taken into account that maybe your process is very different from my process.
Then that's when appropriation becomes a conversation that we, unfortunately, we don't have the economic means to you know, to propel the art the same way as other folks can. So then, you know, when we change the narrative and the dialogue about what it is, and we don't let these other voices in, then now we're starting to see, you know, generations of folks who, I mean, it's, I've been to universities where folks didn't know who Abby Lincoln and right. like A.T. were and stuff right. like that. And I was just like, man, you're getting a degree in jazz?
Basic you don't know history. Art Taylor?
Yeah. It's just like, and that's what we're dealing with now, you know? And so you mentioned the white critic. And I think there's a, we see that as well. We're starting to see like this sort of singular critique. And we're not seeing folks step outside of like the line to really push things. I mean, part of the reason I wanted to come to New York was Amiri Baraka's Black Music. I found it in a box in the basement, and I was just like, and I read Jazz and the White Critic, I read about David, I read about Loft Scene, and I was like, yo, I want to go there and be part of this. You know, how many critics have read that book? You know, how many of them are talking about, you know, that sort of thing? But also just the importance of community. I think more so than anything, that's what I'm really down for, is that I learned jazz in a community. So when you're out in community, you're understanding that things aren't just singular. And but we've sort of become so removed that, you know, we're on Facebook or something like social media, and we're getting our critique from social media and what's popular there or something like that. And it's just like, who's really, you know, stepping out into communities with their feet and seeing what's going on? Because there's a lot still going on that's not being documented, you know, in the interweb and all that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important for the world to talk about, to write about, and just to branch out and to open things up a little more, where we're not dealing with like this singular kind of like Wynton Marsalis-esque idea of what jazz is.
Why don't we listen to a little bit more music? How about that? Of what we're going to hear and be treated with at this festival with David Murray and Saul Williams. So I'm going to play a little track. And I think this track is so refreshing in so many ways. And I'd love to get the feedback of everybody on here. Just pay attention to the lyrics and what he's talking about. Because in the New York Times, they dropped a bombshell article basically saying that YouTube specifically and the algorithms that were programmed for YouTube. Google elected the current leader in Brazil right now. The right-wing fascist rise there, which is very troubling and disconcerting to everyone. With that in mind, I want you to listen to this piece of music.
Hacking the dietary sustenance. Tradition versus health. Hacking the comfort, compliance. Hacking to the rebellious gene. Hacking the doctrine, capitalism in relation to free labor and slavery. Hacking to the history of the bank.
desperation and loneliness, the history of community in the marketplace, hacking the land rights and ownership, hacking the business law of proprietorship, hacking to ambition and greed, hacking the forms of government, cisterns of the control. Hacking the crazy, hacking the lunatic, hacking the star. Hacking the infamous, notorious, the effects of race on the psyche, the effects of poverty, the victims that survived. There's a panel called Survival. Three simple copper wires.
Cycles and Seasons on David Murray's latest recording, Blues for Memo, in tribute to a legendary concert promoter in Turkey. The music covers a wide range of things, including this verse is actually going to be coming to Saul Williams' new film that he's making. Basically addresses technologies and the concept of all of our lives being hacked and compromised and our data being taken away from us. Saul Williams, on July 18th, just dropped his recording of his own called Encrypted and Vulnerable, which is basically going to serve as a score to an upcoming musical and film called Neptune Frost, produced by the one and only Lin-Manuel Miranda. I noticed that there's some little intersection of ideas here from that project to this project.
Of course.
And we are talking about basically how we can be basically an activist, specifically a black activist, and not be viewed in a monolithic way.
You know, first of all, let me just say, I don't identify as an activist. I'm an artist. I use my voice because I have it. I speak on the bullshit that I see because we live it. And I don't know why I would go searching for crazy stuff to talk about when it's all right in front of me. Like the fact that I'm in Belgium right now, you know? And you will go into the airport or the train station and they're like, diamonds since so-and-so and so. But I know the reality behind those diamonds, you know? I know about King Leopold. I know about all the bullshit this country has upheld for years. I'm here. Why not speak on it? This microphone works. Why not use it? So that's pretty much the way that I approach it, you know? Yes, I've been working on a film that's about hackers in East Africa. It's science fiction. I'm shooting in Rwanda, which I think Belgium knows a little bit about as well. hello. very pleasant to be here. in this beautiful park funded by what? And so essentially when Mr. Murray asked me to collaborate on this project with him, I was in the midst of writing this film and graphic novel that I've been working on, which has a few titles. Martin Luther King is the name of the hacker that the story is based on. Neptune Frost is the name of the film. And of course, the focus is technology. And what I'm looking at, essentially, is us as technology. When you see Mr. Murray blow through his horn, that circular breathing and that sense of rhythm and melody and tone, that's technology. We're still living to try to catch up to that, you know? It's like the Tao. The Tao Te Ching says the Tao that can be told is not the eternal Tao. It's like the hole that the wheel goes around. So it's the surface of the wheel that touches the ground, but it's the center of the wheel that's hollow. So we go through that hollowness trying to touch that essence, right? With our words, with our music, with our voices, with our expression, but we know that it's something unsaid. So I think that on one hand, yes, it's I would never point to technology as destroying, you know, society, only because of the fact that, like I said, we are technology. Technology is a reflection of awareness. I think there's a great deal of confusion about what technology actually is. I'm confused by the fact that, you know, all of this digital, you know, all of our digital and virtual advances are based on a very analog exploitation, which brings us back to Rwanda, brings us back to the Congo and the source of the rare minerals and precious minerals that are used and needed in order for our technology to even work, which is no different than that rubber, which is no different than that coffee, no different than that sugar, no different than all the things that we have raped and pillaged and killed for in order to have our comforts and to evolve technologically, right? So I make those connections, and yes, you'll hear it in my work with Mr. Murray, and you hear it in my own work. But yeah, I don't necessarily identify as an activist, and I don't necessarily hold every artist to the fact that they should be, you know, speaking, you know, to the things that I speak to. I speak to the things that I speak to because I have my sense of aesthetic. And like I said, when I look at the shit in front of me, I can't think of anything more interesting to write about. But yeah, other people write about their bank accounts and shit like that, and in good form. Amen.
Well, I did actually write a formal introduction for you, which, you know, didn't include that word. It was more of a combination of being a poet, a rapper, actually one of the original hip-hop artists coming out of New York City.
I'm really like third or fourth generation. We know this from jazz as well. You know what I'm saying? Like, I was a kid listening to Spoonie G and Melly Mel and Grandmaster Flash. And then after that, I started listening to like Run DMC and LL Cool J. And then after that, I started listening to, De La and Jungle Brothers. And then after that, I started listening to like Wu-Tang. And I've gone through like 1, 2, 3, 4,
yeah,
5.
You're,
I'm fifth generation.
I apologize for that.
You know what I'm saying? I guess I am from New York, though.
But yeah, but when you came out with when you dropped you know, my experience of your work when you dropped Lyricist Lounge back in the day changed my life, and that was like a kind of the burgeoning of a whole new you know, sort of avenue in the hip hop arena. Maybe I don't know.
Well,
you tell
it
me.
Connects. It connects to what I think you're talking around is this sense of like. That moment where this, you're talking about essentially the birth of what we call underground hip hop.
Yes.
Right? There was a time, like I remember a time when I owned every hip hop album that was out, because there was only like six of them.
Right. Yes.
And then as it got more and more popular, and then that moment, like that some people point to, like when Dr. Dre released The Chronic or something, where there's this sense of like mainstream and underground and backpacker underground, and this idea that suddenly if you're talking about shit that's other than the gangster shit that's in the mainstream, you belong to the underground. And even platinum artists like De La and Tribe were suddenly put in this backpacker underground sort of group just because they were talking sense. And I don't know, I look at that almost in a conspiratorial way, like who set that up?
Can you elaborate on that a little bit more?
No, what I mean is just that for me, and this goes back to like what we're talking about even with arts and activism, for me, I've always been interested in new styles and new forms first. That's what I'm interested in. Like people walk away and be like, oh my God, I'm so glad you said that. But I'm like, I read a list of 140 names. That was a fucking, you know, like I was trying to reinvent the stanza. You know, I feel like it hit you and you heard it because of the presentation and the way in which, you know, I could have just sat up here and read a speech and it wouldn't hit you the same way. So the form and style is all about that. And when I think of the De La's and Tribes and the People, you know, like basically there was a moment when the style became exploitable and something that could be manufactured, like current pop music today, which, you know, is written by like half the time by like three Swedish musicians that write like 80% of the pop songs, you know? And you wonder why they sound alike, and the answer's right before you, because these three motherfuckers wrote all them songs, right? And so you don't get any new style, you get this manufactured sense of enjoyment, like, oh, this sounds like music, I should be dancing. You know what I'm saying? And something is lost. I feel like something was lost in that moment when the split between the idea of commercial and exploitable hip hop and like what became the underground. And those of us who'd stay focused on the underground, it was not because we only wanted to hear stuff that was positive and for the community. But no, it's because the freshest linguists, the freshest styles, the most inventive imaginations were present there. And that's what that, whatchamacallit shit that you were talking about, Lyricist Lounge, was all about. These were stylists. These were stylists.
Through meditation, I program my heart to beat breakbeats and hum bass lines on exhalation. I burn 7-day candles that melt into 12-inch circles on my mantle and spin funk like myrrh. And I can fade worlds in and out with my mixing patterns, letting the earth spin as I blend in Saturn. Niggas be like spinning windmills, braiding hair, locking, popping, as the sonic force of the soul keeps the planets rocking. The beat don't stop when soulless matter flows into the cosmos trying to be stars. The beat don't stop when Earth sends out satellites to spy on Saturnites and control Mars. Cause niggas got a peace treaty with Martians, and we be keeping them up to date through sacred gibberish like show enough. And it's on, the beat goes on, the beat goes on, the beat goes.
That's what I'm talking about.
And the conspiratorial part comes in is like, what kind of message were you getting, right? So all of a sudden, this one thing is very popular, but everything in the messaging was shit that was detrimental to the community.
Boom.
Whereas other people who were not necessarily trying to be activists or conscious rappers or anything, they was just trying to keep their style fresh while talking about shit that actually mattered. And so the conspiratorial part comes in is like, who put this thing up here so that this mindset, the G lifestyle, the gangster lifestyle, was the thing that was supposed to make money, where people ran around and tried to sign 70,000 acts that sounded the same, that were talking about the same thing, or people were even changing up their styles. Yep. Like they were, I'm not going to do this rap anymore, I'm going to go over here and do this rap. Like, you know, for me personally, it was just, I could make really fucked up music if I wanted to, because it's super easy. I don't have to work hard at it. Like, you know, it's shit's mad easy. I can rhyme cat with cat. I can rhyme bat with bat. You know, that's super easy. But if I want to change something or I want to challenge myself, because it's not about the other people that are out here. It's about challenging myself.
Exactly.
If I hear, here's when I know I find a record that I love. If I feel like I want to start rapping or writing or producing or making something, I've been inspired. Because then I feel, I'm like, shit, I could do that. Like, I could, I'm going to try to better that. I mean, it's an amalgamation of different things that appeal to your ear. But someone came along, like we were talking about earlier, trying to make black folks a monolith once again and said, this is what you're going to listen to. This is a representation of your culture. Here, eat it.
Well, just to tie it all together, this happened with bebop. You know, it got to a point with bebop where it was just like, you know, you tell people that they couldn't dance to something. It wasn't, nobody decided they couldn't dance to it. Clubs decided that they couldn't dance to it. So then it got to a point where you say, well, this isn't dancing music, right? And you say, well, no dancing, please. So it happened the same way that if you were around, you'd just be like, yo, I'd like all of this. It's like, just thinking about it now, it's just like, yo, when Lyricist Lounge came out, I loved it. I liked The Chronic too.
We've only touched the surface here. I hope that we continue the dialogue. Thank you all for joining us, and please give a round of applause to everyone here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Very much.
I would like to thank our panelists, Saul Williams, David Murray, Rashawn Carter, Ko Khai, for joining in this amazing conversation. Certainly one of the best panels I've ever hosted. And since the rapper Ko Khai is celebrating a brand new recording coming out Monday, December 16th, let's hear a little bit more of that from his album, Hubris. And you can find it on Bandcamp.
Sun, baby, where my people are, my people offer for free. She said it's cold out here in the shallow. I keep out there by the reef. We keep them sharks at bay now with these games. So baby, make sure you don't bleed. Whoa. She says she liked the way that the earth felt.
And make sure to follow everything these artists do, including watch out for Saul Williams' upcoming film, Neptune Frost. I can't wait to see that in 2020. And as I mentioned before, he has a new recording out called Encrypted and Vulnerable. To everyone at Jazz Middelheim Festival for making this talk series possible. You can find out more information about next year's Jazz Middelheim Festival on their website. They'll be announcing their 2020 lineup soon, coming in August. And follow us on social media. We have a Facebook page, our Twitter handle, at Checkout Jazz. You can find me on Instagram. Of course, we're a podcast where you can review it, give us your best words, your love. We appreciate it all. And lastly, and perhaps most importantly, have you supported your Jazz Public Radio station yet? Have you supported The Checkout? If you enjoyed this show, either as a radio show or a podcast, now is the time to show your support financially. With an $88 contribution, you can get that new recording, New Masters Reworks Volume 1. Or just go to our website, wbgo.org, to check out all of our thank you gift items. But most importantly, your contribution is going to us as a functioning service, providing you with the best jazz 24/7. 1-800-499-9246. That's 1-800-499-9246. Our volunteers are standing by. Make it easy on yourself. Maybe while you're subscribing to the podcast, just go online and make a contribution there securely, wbgo.org. The Checkout is a production of WBGO Newark. I'm Simon Rettner. Thanks for checking us out.